because it's 6:06. She points to her watch. So, Carl says, examining his cut hand and feeling a bit light-headed. You, Captain Funeral, Agatha turns around to face Millie. Take the wheel. I'm 7. Exactly. When I was 7, I was driving semi-trailers across country. You were not. Just take the wheel. Agatha climbs out of the seat. Agatha, Carl says, what are you doing? He jumps up and manages to grab the steering wheel before they veer off the road. Agatha thumps her body down next to Millie and opens her handbag. She places an exercise book and a small mirror on her lap and holds a ruler up to her face. Carl watches her in the rearview mirror. Agatha, what? Listen, old tricky fingers, Agatha says. I'm busy. I'm not taking calls at the moment. She notes something in her exercise book.
Millie Bird. After some wrong turns and U-turns and arguments, they finally arrive at the Kalgoorlie train station. The air outside is sticky and difficult to breathe in as they wander onto the platform. The train is already there, gradually being loaded up with people and luggage. Tourists take photos of each other in front of the Indian Pacific logo on the side of the train. Men and women in uniform check tickets and direct passengers onto different parts of the train. Families hug and cry and laugh together. Carl buys their tickets and they're directed to their cabin. It's small, with a couch seat that turns into a bed, a wash basin in the corner, and a big window with a curtain pulled across it. This is it, Agatha says, and begins to unfold the bed. There's a commotion on the train platform near their window. A man's voice says,
I can't let you on without a ticket, miss. The train's about to leave.
Oh, for Christ's sakes, Derek, a woman's voice says. I went to school with you. I went out with your bloody brother in seventh form for a bit. I used to come over to your place for a roast on Sundays.
We're on a strict time schedule, Stella, the man's voice says. Can't help you. You know that. Train time and all.
Millie yanks back the curtain. Stella, she says. Millie knocks on the window and jimmies it open. Stella! She calls.
Oh, God, Carl says, and ducks.
All aboard, the man in uniform on the platform calls as he hops on the train. Stella waves a hand at the man and runs up to their window. I can see you, Carl, she says. The train starts to move just as Carl stands. He wobbles on his feet. Where are my keys? Stella says, walking alongside the train. In the bus, Carl says sheepishly. You better find her mum, Stella says. He looks at Millie. We're going to try, he says. You okay, love? Stella says. Millie nods.
Yes.
Promise?
Yes.
Okay.
Stella stops walking and puts her hands in her pockets. The train starts to gather speed, and Millie watches Stella get smaller and smaller on the platform. Millie looks at her beer cozy and says,
But I want you to come with us.
She can feel the tears coming and she can't help them. Because Stella is kind, and her dad is dead, and her mum may as well be. Millie watches Stella until she can't see her anymore and it hurts, deep in her guts. All the grown-ups she knows keep taking bits of her guts away with them and never giving them back.
Part 3.
Carl, the touch typist. When the train starts to move, Carl leaves the girls and Manny to settle into the cabin while he heads to the gents. He cleans his cut, pats his hand dry, and wraps toilet paper around the wound. He catches sight of himself in the mirror. It has always been strange, looking at himself in the mirror, and the exercise has only increased in strangeness the older he has become. He knows his face, and this is not it. How can you be inside a face for 87 years and be surprised by the look of it every time? It suddenly occurs to him that everyone else knows his face better than he does. He doesn't even know his own facial expressions. He tries angry, sad, happy, worried, contemplative, missing, wanted. But he can only see tired. So tired. I am never going to have sex again, he says. Not with this face. He closes his eyes, puckers his lips, and moves toward the mirror. He opens one eye, sees something like death trying to kiss him, and recoils. Right, he says, that's that. But Evie had loved him. And loved this face. He runs his good hand through his hair. He can barely feel the dying strands. He was so jealous of that boy yesterday, the one with the chest like Charlton Heston in Ben-Hur. He wanted everything he had, that body, that girl, that car, that freedom, that way of thinking, that hair, that bloody hair. What he would give to have hair that moved so freely in the wind. But shouldn't that boy be jealous of Carl? Shouldn't he wonder what Carl had seen and done? Shouldn't he look at Carl and think, if only I get to lead a life like yours? When Carl returns to the cabin, Millie has made a new "In here, Mum" sign for the door, and Agatha lies spread eagle on the bed, eyes closed, mouth wide open. Millie puts a finger up to her lips. Shh, Carl nods. Millie motions for him to come closer. She's wearing her backpack.
Can I go explore? She whispers.
Sure, Carl whispers back. Just don't talk to strange men.
You're a strange man?
Carl thinks about this.
Other ones.
Millie closes the door behind her, and Carl puts a pillow under Agatha's head. He sits upright next to her, his back against the wall. His hands in his lap. He stares out the window. Red, green, blue. The earth, the scrub, the sky. Over and over and over again. The low-lying bush and the little trees that look like hunchbacks groping for the ground. And then the occasional big tree reaching for the sun, rising out of the red earth. Manny leans against the wash basin in the corner of the room.
Sleeping.
Carl whispers to him, nodding his head in the direction of Agatha.
She's had a big night.
Agatha snorts and then shifts, turning over. He can feel her warmth next to him. He remembers Evie like this, lying next to him in bed. He closes the curtains. Another thing Carl knows about. Evie, part two. She had been like a dandelion, as if a single breath of his would cause her to fly off into the sky and never be seen again. She was so quiet, too. Not just in the way she spoke, but in the way she conducted herself, as though she were always around sleeping people, tiptoeing everywhere. Barely making footprints on the beach, they walked along together in the early hours of most mornings. Was she too quiet? Maybe. We're all too something, he supposes. And yet, she was the most stable person he has ever known. Every word felt measured out, like she'd poured her words into measuring cups and flattened out the tops of them before she upended them into the world. And there was so much room in her for him, and for everybody else. She was always putting down her guns and raising her arms in the air. Inviting a vulnerability that most couldn't. Carl always felt as if he were thudding everywhere next to her, crunching leaves underfoot with such violence, sneezing as though he were trying to put a tear in the air. He did not like that his body had to make such an impact on things, but when he touched her and she touched him back, she made him feel gentle. And those lines around her eyes, the ones that became deeper and longer and more plentiful, There was something in them that gave him clues that he was understood. "I'm here, Evie," he whispers, as the tears fall down his face. When he opens his eyes, Agatha's sitting up with her face near his. Carl jumps. "Ron, what's the matter? Ron?" she says. She's wearing her glasses and it's dark and they can't really see each other. "Agatha," Carl says. "I'm not..." She puts her hand over his mouth. "Ron," she says. She has both hands on his cheeks. She uses one thumb to brush away his tears.
"I'm sorry," she says.
Carl doesn't know what to say. "It's okay," he says.
"Are you crying because of me?"
"No, Agatha," he says, their noses almost touching.
"I'm sorry, Ron,"
she says, and leans in to kiss Carl. Carl wants her to be Evie more than any other feeling he's ever had. He takes a big breath and closes his eyes and he waits for her lips, but before anything can happen, Agatha's head falls into his chest and she starts to snore. He sighs and helps her back to her former sleeping position. Agatha lies there, her sensible shoes still strapped to her ankles, her head flopping back on the pillow, her mouth wide open, huge, erratic snores vibrating her nose and bouncing off the walls. There's a music to her snores, surely in their rise and fall, an indication of how life works in its ups and downs. He wants to graph the sound and imagines mountains on a page, wide, curvy ones, rippled lines. He opens the curtains a little and stares at Agatha lying next to him. It hits him that he never stares at anyone. He remembers staring as a child, though at the time he didn't realize that people could see what his eyes were doing. Why does it matter that people know he is looking at them? Why is everyone so afraid of being looked at? When did he stop looking people in the eye? There had to be a moment when he realized what it meant. What did it mean? "You seem to have no problems doing it," he whispers to Manny, who stares unblinkingly back at him from the corner of the cabin. He remembers staring at Evie. Somehow, love made staring okay again. They lay in bed in those young days, rubbing noses and curling their feet around each other and staring. He knew every bit of her, but he never stopped staring. There always seemed an angle to know, or a type of light reflected on her body, a crinkle, a fold. Another thing Carl knows about: Agatha isn't Evie. That's for sure. He imagines Agatha standing in uniform at the head of a table, leaning over it, her fists digging into the table, pointing at maps, declaring which countries she's going to invade, men at her command. He likes this new version of womanness he sees in her, one that allows him not to actually be a man. Carl is a man, he knows, insofar as he has the organ that identifies him as one, but he has never known how to walk or talk or look like one. Even now, at 87 years old, he feels like a small boy taking a sneaky puff on his father's cigar, trying on his father's work shirt. Agatha's nose wiggles and she smacks her lips. Her hands are folded across her stomach. He studies her fingers, they're big and thick, and he pictures them dumping loosely and heavily onto typewriter keys, like dropping a bag of clothes from 7 stories high. He lies down next to Agatha on the small bed, folding his arms across his body, listening to Agatha snore, her back against his arm. Out the window, there are farmhouses in the distance, rusted-out cars and unidentifiable machines scattered around them as though they've fallen from the sky. Grass poking out of windows and through tires and out of boots like one of those men whose hair spills over their collar. Carl peeks under his shirt, flexes his chest. Sighs. He rubs his neck. Rain dribbles down the windows. He can see where it is and isn't raining out on the horizon. Patches of dark hovering over the desert like bruises, so heavy in the sky. Agatha's exercise book rests on the bed next to her. He He looks at the book, looks at her, looks at the book again. Age, the cover says in spidery handwriting. In small, almost indecipherable letters, Agatha Panthers, hands off, has been scrawled across the bottom. Keeping one eye on her, he picks it up, then flicks the pages over with his thumb. The handwriting inside is so angry, like it's trying to squash the paper. It's not a nice feeling, looking at this. He puts the book back. He feels the rhythm of the train underneath his back, the movement of it, like rocking, like nostalgia.
Millie Bird. Millie sits on the bench seat in the common area of the carriage and rests the back of her head against the window. Across from her, a lady reads a book to a little girl. She's littler than Millie. The book doesn't have many words to it and asks really easy questions. "What does a cow do?" says the mum and prompts the little girl.
"Moo."
And the little girl just mimics the mum, like an echo. And the mum congratulates the little girl, as if she invented cows. The little girl sits with her head up high, swinging her legs, and the mum leans in and kisses her on the head. Millie closes her eyes and wishes so much that it was her head. So when the mum says, "What does a horse do?" Millie says, "Neigh!" in her best horse voice. She even lifts her head back like a horse does and looks up at the mum, hoping for something. But the mum looks at Millie like she has done something wrong. And suddenly Millie is filled with hatred for this tiny girl. "You know," she says, jumping off the seat and looking straight at her, "you could die today." And she walks into the next carriage. "Sandwiches." "What? And curtains?" "Read this. Potatoes." Millie wanders into the restaurant carriage and slides into a booth. The vinyl seat sticks to the backs of her legs. She watches the world go by through the train window. And if she puts her hands around her eyes like goggles, the whole world is red and green and yellow streaks, moving so fast. There is something terrifying about that, but also something exciting. It is both things, and she thinks, everything is always both things. She is sad to say goodbye to Stella, but she is happy to go with Carl and Agatha. She is sad her dad died, but she is happy his body isn't hurting anymore. She loves her mum, but she hates her too. Can you love and hate the same person? If you love them more than you hate them, will they forgive you? Will they let you find them? She takes off her goggles, leans back in her seat, and surveys the length of everything out there. And it feels as if nothing will ever, ever end or begin. A lady wearing the Indian Pacific uniform walks down the carriage towards Millie. She has long blonde hair and eyes that shine when she smiles.
"Excuse me," Millie says in her most polite voice. "When will we get to Melbourne? I need to be there in 2 days."
The lady smiles sympathetically at Millie.
"Okay, love," she says.
"I know it's a bit of a trek." She reaches into her pocket. "Here," she says, and hands Millie a caramello koala. Millie squints at the caramello koala in her palm. She looks up at the lady.
"I need to be there in 2 days," she repeats.
The lady laughs. "I'll bring you a colouring book," she says, and walks off. Millie bites into the koala's legs just as a man's voice comes over the loudspeaker.
"Good morning, everyone," it says. "If you've just joined us at Kalgoorlie, welcome on aboard the Indian Pacific. We trust you'll enjoy your journey. I'll be using this PA system to not only make a few announcements along the way, but to also give you a few facts about this glorious country of ours. We'll soon be travelling through the Nullarbor Plain. Nullarbor derives from Latin and means no trees. But the plain is covered with blue bush and salt bush plants, hardy shrubs that are drought-resistant and salt-tolerant. The plain is the world's largest single piece of limestone, is 20 to 25 million years old and is twice the size of England. It is also a foremost shallow seabed and is mostly made up of seashells.
Millie presses her face against the window.
So this is what the bottom of the sea looks like, she says.
She'll have to remember to tell Stella. She puts it in the part of her brain that remembers things for later. At the next table, a boy about her age reads a comic. On the front is a picture of a cartoon man wearing a cape. His arm thrust high in front of him, the wind in his hair, a person tucked under his arm. A building burns beneath them. He has a wristband, and it has lights and buttons all over it. Millie looks down at her dad's beer cozy on her forearm. She imagines herself with a cape, flying down the aisles of the train, hovering over everyone and saving them. Flying right out of this train and straight to Melbourne. Her mum would have to forgive her, because she will have been so good. She locks eyes with the boy over the top of the comic. He seems to be egging her on. So Millie sneaks into the first-class carriage. Then I took the apple. Was firstly understood as... How did that? Nova Scotia? And steals a white tablecloth. From her backpack, she pulls out her funeral pencil case, writes CF on the tablecloth in thick black marker, and ties it around her neck. She takes off her gumboots and writes C on the right one and F on the left one. She writes, In here, Mum, on one forearm, and Sorry, Mum, on the other. She gathers up all the menus in the restaurant carriage and, next to the Welcome to the Indian Pacific heading, writes in her very best writing, You are all going to die, underneath in bold letters. It's okay, she draws a happy face. She watches a lady carefully apply lipstick on her lips, and then, when the lady's not looking, Millie reaches into her handbag and takes the lipstick.
Borrowing, Millie says.
She uses it to write her message on the bottom of windows, on the mirrors in the toilets and on the tabletops in the restaurant. No one seems to notice. She walks down the aisles of the carriages, feeling her white cape billowing out behind her, feeling like her gumboots have springs on the bottoms. People look at her. She smiles at them. Her smile feels as though it could provide all the world's electricity. She propels herself down the aisle, her arm up high in front of her body, her hand balled in a fist. An old lady puts her hand on the seat next to her as if she is imagining the warmth of someone there. Millie gets down on her knees and slides on the ground toward her.
You're going to die someday, she says.
The lady looks down at Millie.
I hope so, dear,
she says, patting Millie on the head. A girl sits on the floor of the lounge carriage brushing the hair of a Barbie.
You're going to die someday, Millie says, standing over her.
The girl doesn't look up.
You are!
I know, Millie says. A dad feeds a toddler while trying to stop two other boys from punching each other.
You're all going to die someday, Millie says, standing proudly,
the beer cozy high above her head. The dad tries to cover his kid's ears.
Rack off, he says.
The mum, reading a magazine nearby, rolls her eyes.
She's just a kid, Jared.
So was Charles Manson once.
I'm not a kid, Jared,
Millie whispers as she walks away. There is a baby in a pram. Millie lets him grab her finger. She moves in close to his head.
You'll die too, she whispers.
He smiles at her, farts, and smiles a little more.
That kid's a bloody weirdo.
I know.
She finds a door with Derek Fauntleroy, head conductor, written on it. She pushes the door ajar and sees a man sitting at a desk with his head in his hands and a phone up to his ear.
Dad, I can't. I'm working.
This is my real job. God, Dad!
Why don't you ask Golden Boy? Well, it's the bloody truth. Oh, don't hang up. Dad! Dad! Oh, shit.
Millie uses the lipstick to write on the window opposite his office.
It's okay.
The letters seem to fly along the line of the horizon. Millie sits under one of the tables in the restaurant carriage. Every single person is sad, and either showing it or hiding it. And some have been sad for too long, and some haven't been sad for long enough. And the thought of helping everyone is very, very exhausting.
Is this what a superhero is supposed to feel like? She says, pressing her face into the chair cushion.
A boy pokes his head underneath the table and shimmies in next to her. It's the boy she saw before with the superhero comic. His hair is brown, and his eyes seem to take up his whole face. He and Millie stare at each other.
I've been on this train 37 times, he says to Millie eventually.
Good for you, she says.
I know everything about it. Ask me anything.
I'm busy.
You're a superhero,
he says, pointing to her cape.
Yeah,
she says.
So am I.
Which one are you?
He sighs, leans on his elbow, and rests his chin on his hand.
It's a secret.
I'm Captain Funeral.
He sits up.
I'm Captain Everything.
What do you do?
Everything, he says.
He rolls his eyes.
Duh. What do you do?
Nothing yet.
Some sneakers and thongs and bare feet walk past.
Do you like feet?
The boy says. Millie considers this.
Mostly, she answers.
My mum says never to touch anyone's feet. She says that after doorknobs, handrails and hairy backs, they're the most disgusting thing.
There's more disgusting things.
Like what?
Boys.
Girls are more disgusting.
Poop,
Millie says.
Poop on your face, maybe.
My grandma had warts all over her eyelids.
Maybe she was a witch.
You're gonna
die someday, I know.
How do you know?
Everybody knows.
You were eavesdropping.
No, I wasn't.
Yes, you were.
He sits back against the leg of the seat.
Want some of my muesli bar?
Millie shrugs.
Okay.
They chew loudly together. Millie eats the portion quickly. The boy watches her. He reaches into his pocket, pulls out some crackers, and hands them to Millie. She eats them gratefully.
Where are you going anyway?
A trip?
The boy rolls his eyes again.
Obviously.
Where?
She takes a deep breath.
We're trying to find my mum. She forgot to pick me up. Then all her stuff was gone from the house, and before that Dad was at the hospital, and then he died. And I think that's why she forgot to pick me up, and why she wants to go far away, and all I need to do is find her before she goes far away.
Oh.
Is your mum nice? Millie says.
She's okay.
What kind of stuff does she do?
Mum stuff.
Like what?
Get me stuff, pick me up from stuff, make me stuff, that sort of thing.
My mum's taking me to Movie World, Millie says. On the Gold Coast? You know, when we find her.
Went there last year.
We'll probably go to SeaWorld after that.
The dolphin show there was okay, I guess.
My mum's in the dolphin show,
Millie says.
I didn't see her.
You wouldn't know her.
Your mum isn't in the dolphin show.
We're probably going to outer space after that.
You can't go to outer space,
the boy says, crossing his arms.
Who says?
Everybody says.
Mum knows a guy that can go to space.
An astronaut?
He's just rich.
You know rich people?
Some.
I know lots of rich people.
No, you don't.
Yes, I do. There's a girl at my school who buys lunch every day.
So? Millie says.
Every day.
Can she go to outer space?
Probably.
Where will she buy lunch?
She'll buy beforehand, the boy says. Obviously.
What's your real name?
Not telling. What's your real name?
Millie Bird.
Mine's Jeremy.
Jeremy what?
No, Jeremy Jacobs.
I like your name.
Thanks. Yours is okay too.
Thanks.
They hear a voice from the other end of the carriage.
Excuse me, sir.
Jeremy's eyes widen.
That's Derek, he whispers. The head conductor.
Derek walks past them. Millie can see only his feet. Black, shiny shoes. A straight, fast walk.
No breathing on the windows, sir,
he says.
Mum says he used to be a parking inspector,
Jeremy says.
But,
he leans in closer to Millie,
he got fired. He used to fiddle with the parking meters so he could give more tickets.
Millie crawls out from under the table to get a look at him. She can only see him from behind, but can tell it's the man who was on the phone. His shirt is tucked in and his trousers don't have any creases in them. He wipes down the tables and the seats and the walls and any surface there is. He seems to be in a race against himself. A child with Vegemite all over her face sits at one of the tables while her mum lines up at the food counter. Derek wipes her face with the cloth roughly, and she sits there stunned for a few moments, and then starts to cry. Derek passes the mother as he walks away from the screaming child.
No crying in the restaurant carriage, he says.
Parking inspectors go to hell,
Millie says, crawling back under the table.
What?
Dad said.
Oh.
The woman who gave Millie a caramello koala pokes her head under the table.
Found a friend, Jeremy?
She's not a friend, Mom.
She kneels on the floor.
Girlfriend, then?
Mom? Gross.
She smiles at Millie, and Millie smiles back.
She seems nice,
Jeremy's mum says.
Well, she's not.
He's not very nice either,
Millie says. Jeremy's mum laughs.
You two would make the perfect couple.
Mum!
Jeremy says, crossing his arms. I'm on a break soon, darling, she says to Jeremy. Why don't you come have dinner with me? He looks at her sideways.
Can we play Uno?
Of course, darling, she says. Black, shiny shoes stop next to Jeremy's mum.
Melissa,
a voice says.
FYI, you're not paid to sit on the floor.
Okay, Derek, Jeremy's mum says. The black, shiny shoes walk away.
He's scary, Mum,
Jeremy says. I don't like him.
Oh, darling, don't be too hard on him. He's just a little kid, really.
No, he's not. He's a grown-up.
Darling, I mean inside.
She tickles his belly. Millie puts her hands on her own belly. Jeremy's mum is so beautiful and smells like a mum, so Millie says,
You're very beautiful and you smell like a mum.
And the woman's face softens, and she puts a warm, warm hand on Millie's leg and says, Thank you, darling. And Millie wants to curl up in her arms and stay there and never leave. But she doesn't do that at all because the lady isn't her mum, and you can't really do that to mums who aren't yours. But you should be able to hug all the mums who aren't yours, because some people don't have mums, and what are they supposed to do with all the hugs they have?
Agatha Panther. 2:02 p.m. Agatha wakes with a start when an announcement is made over the loudspeaker. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would kindly move your clocks forward an hour and a half. Throughout this journey, we'll be existing on what we call train time. We'll keep you updated as to further adjustments. Agatha sits up. Train time? She moves all her watches forward. 3:32. Agatha gets out her complaint letters notepad and pen and starts writing. Dear... Her hand jolts as the carriage shakes and the R streaks across the page. Ah! Agatha says, tearing off the sheet of paper and crumpling it. Dear... She writes again and stops. Agatha looks out the window. They're zipping through the bush. Everything always crackles and hisses at her in the Australian bush. The trees splayed out in the air like they're in agony. And that dirt, that deep red dirt that gets under your fingernails, stains your clothes, and never seems to leave you. She suddenly thinks of Ron's hair. Red hair, like copper wire, flattened atop his head with a wave at the front and a perfect part on one side. She was 15 when she met him, he 18. It was a vulnerable and mysterious time. She remembers not often hearing her own voice. She remembers feeling so ridiculous just being alive. Her skin always felt watched. Eye contact was this dangerous thing. Her body was taking her to places she didn't want to go, to this strange address she had only heard of as womanhood. No one ever told her what to do once she got there. She just bumbled about and hoped no one noticed what was going on underneath her clothes. She had seen Ron for the first time in the park, near her grandmother's house. She was walking home from school, and she knew she was thinking too hard about how to walk, that she was thinking too hard about how to move her arms, and that this must be obvious to everyone watching her. What was the first thing he said to her? "Chuck us the ball, would you?" She thinks this is it. The boys were playing cricket. She heard him, but she didn't look up. She felt her body tightening as she saw the ball out of the corner of her eye, rolling toward her feet. And that ball kept coming, rolling toward her like a snowball, growing bigger and bigger in her peripheral vision. "Chuck us the ball, would you?" And then there was the look he gave her, under a hand that was blocking the sun, and the way he sauntered over to her, and his voice, and the way he gestured, and the way he stood. "Can't you pick up a ball?" he said, and smiled at her as he picked it up. It wasn't really a question. Agatha looked at the ground. "Okay, then," he said, and walked away. But there was a hesitation in his step that Agatha noticed and kept and felt as she lay in her bed that night, eyes wide open, gazing up at the ceiling. And later, when they were married and owned a house and lived an entire life together, he put his hand on the crown of her head after her mother died. It was just in passing, as he walked from the sink to his chair. But his hand on her head felt so heavy with love that it seemed to stop her head from falling forward onto her chest. He made her a bonnox every night, without her having to ask for it. He didn't gamble or smoke. He read the daily news out loud to her when she was sick. He ate her meatloaf, even when it was terrible. He didn't smile much, but he never complained. Did this make him a good person? Was he a good person? Was he a better person than her, than most? 3:46. But there was this. Well into their marriage, Agatha saw Ron looking at another woman's bottom. It was what's-her-name from next door, Tallulah or Tiffany or some kind of name they probably put on handbags, and she had been pruning her rosebush in clothes that would make a prostitute blush. Her undergarments rose out of the top of her jeans as though they were trying to make their way to her neck. Like a dog yanking at its chain, trying to get to the food bowl. He was waiting in the car, and Agatha saw his face through the glass as she locked the door to the house. They had not had sex in years, but there was still something about this situation that shook Agatha. Something about her husband's face, blank to the untrained eye, but it was the slitting of the eyes that was different, the slight parting of the mouth. Something about this bottom in the air, something about the space between his face and that bottom, Something about what Agatha wasn't. She opened the car door and climbed in. When she sat down, she felt her bottom spread out over the whole seat, right to the very edges. Handbag name waved to them as they drove past, all red lips and curved lines. Ron's mouth was clamped shut, flatlining under his nose like a heart rate monitor. Beep, his mouth seemed to say. Beep, she says now, looking out the train window. 3:52. She looks at the sheet of paper in front of her. Dear, she says. She wonders what her face looked like to her husband. She cannot recall ever looking at him with a soft face. She wonders if he ever felt love in his fingers and toes for her. There had been a lilt of impatience in her voice, always hovering around her words. She never asked him selfless questions. If she poured orange juice for both of them, she would always take the bigger glass. She would walk through a door, knowing full well that he was following, and allow the door to close behind her. She didn't massage his crook neck, just let him crane it to one side and push his own fingers feebly into the muscle, feeling around for the source of pain like a mechanic. She saw his grimace, but would continue spooning mashed potato into her mouth. His discomfort had seemed irrelevant to her, as though he were one of those orphan children in a war-torn country. Was she testing him? Had the entire relationship been a challenge, a standoff? Just how much can you take, Ron? How much are you willing to take, and why? Why, Ron, are you willing to take this? 4:01. She was a bad person to Ron. The sentence arrives in her head so loudly, it is as if she has yelled it. She was a bad person to Ron, purely because she could be, because it was easy, because he didn't stop her.
Carl the Touch Typist. Carl sits in one of the booths in the Matilda Cafe, sharing a bottle of wine with Manny and watching the sun set over the desert. The train squeaks and creaks, and the sound of that, the gentle constancy of it, is comforting, like rain on a roof. A dust devil touches down on the horizon, and Carl watches with wide eyes as it twirls and twists, and then disappears completely. Carl unwraps the toilet paper from around his hand and examines it. He shows it to Manny, wiggling his eyebrows.
Should have seen the other guy.
Carl spreads Evie's typewriter keys on the table in front of him. Forgot what, Manny? He says, sighing. He shuffles the keys around. Rift. Goo. He turns to Manny. Is there such a thing? An elderly couple walks into the carriage. They smile at Carl as they sit down in another booth. Carl nods at them politely. The woman opens her book and begins to read. The man winks at Carl.
Enjoying the train?
Oh, yes, Carl says, very much.
Those trees, the man says, pointing out the window.
They're dead, he nudges his wife. They're dead, but they have new sprouts.
His wife doesn't react, so he looks to Carl for a response.
Well, I'll be, Carl says.
The man turns to his wife, who doesn't lift her eyes from her book.
I'll just go have a bow peep at what they've got, he says.
He returns with two cups of tea.
Ow, he says, placing them on the table. Oh, boy, is that hot? Whew.
He blows on his hands and rubs them together dramatically.
Oh, boy, they're hot.
His wife doesn't flinch and continues to read.
Those trees, he says again, taking his seat and gesturing toward the window. New sprouts.
The other staff were nice, the woman says suddenly, as if her husband hasn't been talking at all, saying it with the confused urgency of someone who has just woken up from a dream.
What?
The husband says.
The other staff were nice, she says, not raising her voice.
The other staff were nine? What?
Nice,
she says, not taking her eyes from her book.
Oh, he says.
Nice. He sips his tea while she reads her book. Carl glances at her face.
She appears so unmoved by this man, so beyond any kind of expression for him.
"Why do they get to be alive?"
Carl whispers. He glances sideways at Manny.
"I know, I know."
The table under his fingertips feels cool and hard as he types on it.
"That's harsh, but..."
He stares at the man, still shaking his head at the trees out the window, and the woman not in love with him in any way.
"I loved Evie, and she loved me. Shouldn't we get some kind of reward for that?"
Carl turns to Manny, who looks straight ahead at the couple.
"Manny,"
Carl says, flushing pink with embarrassment,
"don't make it so obvious we're talking about them."
Carl turns Manny's face toward him. He holds Manny's upper arm while he does it and can feel the curve of Manny's muscle.
"Manny," he says.
Carl unbuttons the top of Manny's shirt and looks in.
"Wow,"
he says. Carl lifts up the bottom of Manny's shirt.
"Wow,"
he says again, rubbing Manny's stomach. "Hello, sir," a voice says, and Carl jumps. A man in an Indian Pacific uniform stands at the end of Carl's table. A notepad hangs from a piece of string that dangles around his neck. A dishcloth is folded neatly over his belt. "I'm Derek, the head conductor." He taps a forefinger on his name badge. He runs a finger softly over the part of his hair and uses the heel of his hand to flatten his fringe to the side.
"Hi, Derek, the head conductor," Carl says. "I'm Carl, the touch typist."
"Dining with us this evening, sir?"
"Sure am, sir," Carl replies.
He puts an arm around Manny.
"Me and my friend here. And the wife and grandkid."
"Sir," Derek says in a low voice, "we don't allow objects of sexual fantasy on the train."
"Objects of what now?" Carl says, leaning forward.
"What you do in your own time is none of our concern, but while you're on this train..."
"Sorry, objects of what? I don't know what your caper is."
"My caper? But you must remove this sex doll from the dining carriage ASAP.
Carl slides his arm from Manny's shoulders. He looks at Manny apologetically. He puts his elbows on the table and links his hands together.
"Manny is not one of those," he says quietly.
"Look," Derek says, holding out the notepad around his neck and scribbling on it, "I don't know what your type call them these days, but get it out of my sight, understand?" He rips the sheet of paper off the notepad and places it forcefully on the table in front of Carl. "One times sexual misconduct." The note reads in capital letters. "Sexual" is underlined. Before Carl can answer, Millie bounds into the carriage.
"Carl,"
she says, sliding in next to Manny.
"Manny,"
she says, and hugs him. Agatha is not far behind and sits on the opposite side of the booth. Carl pockets the piece of paper.
"That's a warning," Derek says. "Three of those, and you're off the train, sir."
"A warning for what?"
Millie says.
"Excuse me," Agatha says to Derek, her eyes on his name badge.
"What time do you make it?"
She seems agitated. Derek checks his watch. 6:30 p.m., he pauses. "Train time."
"You know,"
Agatha says, tapping a finger on the table,
"you can't just change the time and call it what you want."
"FYI, yes I can," Derek says. He leans back on his heels and folds his arms across his chest.
"Think of this as my house. While you're in my house, we use my time."
"What about Millie time?"
Millie says.
"Yeah," Carl says, "and Carl time."
"No," Derek says. He places both hands on the table.
"No,
just train time." And after an elongated look at each of them, he says, "My house," and turns, then walks down the aisle and out of the carriage.
"Pleasant fella," Carl mutters.
"Who wants Sanger's?" He produces three sandwiches in a plastic bag from under the table.
"Me,"
Millie says, raising her hand. Carl hands one to Millie and one to Agatha.
"Thank you,"
Millie says, and unwraps hers.
"What time do you make it, typist?"
Agatha says, snatching at the sandwich. Carl looks at his forearm.
"Freckle 30 by my watch," he says. "What time do you make it, Millie?"
"Hair o'clock,"
she says, giggling. Agatha still appears agitated.
"All I know is that it's time for a drink, Agatha,"
Carl says in what he hopes is a sympathetic voice.
"You can have Manny's," he says.
Do you mind, Manny? He doesn't mind. He fills up the second glass and pushes it toward her. Agatha takes the glass, slams back the wine, and pushes it toward Carl. She wipes her arm across her mouth and eyes Carl as though she's testing a bartender. Carl laughs nervously and pours Agatha another drink. He sits up tall and says, in his deepest voice,
"So, what did you get up to today, Millie? You look like you've been busy."
She's wearing some sort of homemade cape and has decorated her arms in letters and colours.
"I met a boy," she replies.
"Right," he says. "Do girls your age usually meet boys?"
"He said he has something to show me," she says, chewing on her sandwich. "I'm very excited."
"Right," Carl says. "Yeah, what about you, Agatha?"
She doesn't say a word, just throws back the second drink and pushes the glass toward him again.
"Maybe some water for the next one," he says, his voice wavering a little.
Agatha taps her finger on the side of the glass. "Right," he hiccups. He puts his hand over his mouth.
"What?"
"Here's the dessert you ordered,"
a woman in an Indian Pacific uniform says, walking up to them and handing them a tub of yogurt each. She winks at Millie. Millie winks back.
"But I didn't," Carl says.
The woman, Melissa, according to her badge, puts a hand on his shoulder and a finger up to her lips. His shoulder melts into the heat of her hand.
Millie Bird.
"Earth to Captain Funeral. Captain Everything to Captain Funeral. Over."
"Psst." Millie looks under the table. Jeremy is down there. She slips off her seat and slides in next to him.
"Hi, Captain Everything," she says.
"Who's that?"
he says.
"Who's who?"
Millie says.
"The,"
he says, pointing to Manny.
"Manny, he's a dead thing."
"No, he isn't."
He knocks on Manny's leg.
"He's plastic. He's our friend. He saved my life."
The boy stares at the mannequin.
"You can't have a plastic man for a friend."
"Who says?"
"The Bible."
"No, it doesn't."
"Does he have a, you know, thingy?"
He wiggles his index finger in the air.
"I don't think so."
They both eye Manny's crotch uncertainly.
"Have you ever seen a dead thing?"
Millie asks Jeremy.
"Yeah, of course, all the time."
"Like what?"
"Like, I don't know, some things. Bet you haven't."
"Bet I have."
"Like what?"
Millie pulls her book of dead things out of her backpack, opens it up and hands it to him.
"Like all of these things. Rambo, the old man, Spider, my dad, there's more."
"Your dad?"
"What do you think happens when you die?"
Jeremy pulls a donut out of his pocket and chews thoughtfully on it.
"A spaceship comes and takes you away."
"Where to?"
"Another planet, of course."
"Which planet?"
"Pluto, maybe. Jupiter, too."
"Who drives the spaceship?"
"God."
"God drives the spaceship?" "Of course." "But doesn't he have a lot of other things to do, like help people and run the universe and all that?"
"He has sidekicks."
"Like elves?"
"Kinda. They don't sing songs, though, if that's what you're thinking."
"How do you know so much?"
Millie asks. He shrugs.
"You pick up stuff. Your mum's old."
"She's not my mum. I told you about my mum."
"I was just testing you."
"Want me to show you how to make walking poems?"
Millie asks.
"Yeah,"
he says. Jeremy and Millie crawl out from underneath the table, down the aisle and into the next carriage without Agatha and Carl noticing. Millie and Jeremy sit on the ground outside the toilet in the rear carriage.
"Isn't it funny?" Millie whispers to Jeremy. "To think that someone is going to the toilet right